of them still go together. All right. Hi, everyone on Zoom. I am sober today, by the grace of God. Thank you guys for having me. Gustav is in this room, and he and I went to college together, and we ran into each other at a Palisades meeting a while back, and him and Heather were like, "Hey, you need to come to our meeting," and here we are. So thank you guys for inviting me. And congratulations to Jack. Happy birthday. Yeah, happy birthday, Jack. That's awesome. And people counting days. I remember counting days, and it's real. It's real different than now. So I hope you stay, and I hope you get what I have now. Because it is possible, and there's no real secret sauce like the stuff that was read to us this morning. Man, I'm tired. Tonight, the stuff that was read to us tonight, I just kept hearing, "Well, that's how you do it. Well, that's how you do it. Well, that's how you do it." People are like, "I don't know why some people get to keep their seat and why some people don't." And it's like it's right here in front of us. And if we really dissect that like it, we can stay stopped with rigorous honesty. With that willingness, with our open-mindedness, we can stay stopped. If we're willing to take direction from each other, somebody who's a step or few in front of us and who has what we want, it is possible. So let's see what it was like. I was born in Oakland, and I was born to married parents. The first one, I have an older half-sister with my same dad. I don't really remember anything until my mom was pregnant with my sister. I was four. And I wanted a sister so bad. I like went to their bedroom window and I prayed in the window, please just give me a sister. Whatever's out there, give me a sister. We're not religious. My mom like introduced me to a Unitary church, and like it's non-denominational and anybody's welcome. And so I didn't have like a conception of God that was driven into me that so I got to choose my conception of God from a young age, and I do feel really grateful for that. I think that helped me connect with this God that you guys offered me. And I do remember praying at that window, looking out into our backyard, just begging for a sister. It was like the Santa Claus God that they talk about, like you like give me this thing and I won't do that thing, right? Like the negotiating kind of thing. And then my sister was born, and my sister was born in that room. And during the birth, my mom wanted to smell the pine tree, so my dad went to the backyard and he chopped off one of the branches and like laid it in the bed with her. And so like the nature that I was praying to outside was like brought in, and it was there. And then a girl came out, and it was like literally the answer to my greatest life's desire. And so for me, that was like whatever it was, like answered my prayers. And I got to do skin to skin with her, and like I got to name her middle name, and it was like such a profound experience in my life that's important to my story, because immediately after she like turned blue and had to get rushed to the hospital, and part of my belief system for the up until working the steps and in sobriety and getting super sober, sober AF. I had a God that would give me whatever I wanted, but just be ready because it's also going to get taken away. So my sister lived, and yet everything was different from that moment on. And so, and that's the kind of God that I came into the rooms with. Like, yeah, you get it, but like it was always the other shoe's going to drop, and it was God's fault. I would blame God before I came into this room. So my sister was born with Down syndrome and a one chamber heart. So all her blood was just mixing together. So she had her first open heart surgery like immediately. My dad, the way he attached to her was like, if something is wrong with her, like something must be wrong with me. And like he put a lot of pressure then on me to be like this golden child of like, well, let me show you what this child's doing, and you can judge me by this child and not that child. I didn't know that until I got sober and looked at my life and my patterns and my story. So there was a lot, I felt a lot of pressure growing up to be enough. And that's a thread throughout my whole story is like just wanting to be enough and not being good enough. And so like a mantra that I use regularly is just like, I have enough, I do enough, I am enough. And like when I feel insecure, afraid, less than, when I'm like having the inferiority complex, there's like that saying, the inferiority complex and an egomaniac, like we have them both. That's our Jekyll and Hyde. Like we think we're better than, and we also think we're less than as alcoholics. And like that was my truth too. Like, oh, you don't know me, like, right? And then also like, please love me, like please just like underneath all that. And so yeah, so I think that's an important part of my story. My parents ended up getting divorced a few years later. My sister got diagnosed with leukemia, and I was 7 and she was 3, and my dad moved back to where he was from and remarried his first wife. So that also, like, I made up the story, like, I wasn't worth it to stay. I'm not enough, right? Like, this, I think it's important for me to talk about this in my story when I share. I haven't shared my whole story for 45 minutes in a long time. And I had to look at the patterns of thoughts, because it's a three-pronged disease, right? It's a mental obsession, it's the spiritual malady, meaning spiritual sickness, and we have the physical allergy. So I had to look at like, what were my mental obsessions that I came in here? Once you took the alcohol and drugs away from me, like, what is my mind still obsessing about when the obsession to use is lifted? Like, that's how I got emotional sobriety. It's like looking at that, and it was these things about not being enough and I'm not worth it. And I made up that story at 7, and I played it out in almost every relationship until I got sober and got to do this deeper work and look at that shortcoming and the character defects that came out of that. So I was taught that shortcomings are when we don't do something, when we don't do what we need to do, and character defects are when we're doing too much that we're not supposed to be doing, and that I have both of them for sure. When I am sick and suffering, and in my alcoholism, my life was just trying to survive between those two things, using those two things to try to survive. And it was what was blocking me from thriving. So I became my mom's, like, it was very codependent. I became like her helper. I was like, had to grow up really fast. And so I remember, like, my first drug of choice was sugar. And there's a lot of sugar in alcohol, so that makes sense to me. I did everything that I later did for drugs and alcohol, I like basically did for sugar as a kid. And so I lost my two front teeth right here from like sneaking a red vine, like a days after Halloween, which my sobriety day is 11/3/11, right after Halloween. So that's funny too. I never put those two together. And I went behind my bedroom door. So I was like between the door and the wall before school. I like had to get my fix. And I like couldn't get it because it was stale. And I yanked it and I lost two teeth over it. And it was just like the beginning of, like the fun, and then fun with problems, and then problems. Like I would like hustle. I realized when my dad left, we went on food stamps and welfare and Medi-Cal, whatever it was called then. And my mom sold like everything to like keep, because my sister was having chemo in the hospital and couldn't like speak. My mom had to be there all the time. And so my life changed drastically. And I realized, like, I made up also one of my stories, one of the obsessive thoughts is that money is freedom. And there, like, you do have more freedom to make choices if you have the finances to support it. And so I like understood that at that point, but like money, I'm very clear now, is not freedom, because my bottom was a spiritual bottom. I was so spiritually sick that I wanted to, I was living in Agoura and I was working in Malibu, and I was like driving the canyon, and on the way to work, like regularly, I would think about just driving off and making it look like an accident so that it wouldn't hurt my family so bad. And then on the way back, I would be drunk, and I would like very well could have driven off or killed myself or someone else. So my bottom was like wanting to commit suicide. My bottom was very spiritually sick. And so I did not have the same story of like homelessness. And I do think that's important to mention, is that everybody's story is going to be different. And if my story doesn't sound like yours, hopefully the feelings that I'm talking about that I went through as an alcoholic do, or the thoughts that I do, or the solution is going to be the same no matter what your story is. So Christina and I come from very different backgrounds. We have completely different stories. Our lives today are parallel, like in alignment with each other, but they look very different on the surface. And we have the same solution. And I hope that that is the message that you can take away today, no matter what you hear from my story. So I thought money was freedom. So I was like, I'm gonna hustle the block for whatever I can. I used to sell cootie catchers for a quarter. I would wash your windows and your cars. I would walk your dogs. I like sewed scrunchies and sold those door to door. And what I did with the money, all of it went to sugar and candy. And I would go to 7-Eleven and I'd get a Slurpee and I'd buy the candy. And then I would sort the candy and I'd keep the good stuff for myself. And I would like share the shitty flavors with my friends, just like I later did with alcohol. Like I'd have like at the time in college, it was probably like Smirnoff or Sky or something I thought was fancy in my room in the closet. And I would give like the pop off in the Jungle Juice for my friends to come over. You know what I mean? Like I would share the shitty stuff. Yeah, pop off. And so anyways, my sugar addiction, I never really looked at it until I got sober. And then I was able to, I looked at all my patterns of my life through these steps. And I was like, well, this was re repetitive. This was like, consistent. And that was it. Like I would give you stuff so that you would be friends with me. You'd think I was enough. You'd love me. You'd want to be around me. And I would share like just enough to have you hooked in. And then I would like selfishly use the rest for myself, or right, keep it, because I was better than, and I get your stuff, but like I'm also less than, and I need you here. So I played high school basketball, and I was really good, and I think that kept me like straight enough through that time of my life. The first time I really got wasted was at my house, because my mom just she was doing the best that she could. Like truly, I do believe that, and she could also just like not be in more than one place at once, and I was cunning, baffling, and powerful as an alcoholic, and I was very slippery. So I lied a lot. I cheated on my SATs to get into college. That is part of my alcoholism. And so, anyways, everyone, like there was a group of us at my house, and it was super like debauchery, debauchery. You got it. My best thinking was, I'm going to keep all these bottles and we're going to put like the memories of the night. I mean, I'm like 14 or whatever. And we're going to put the memories of the night into the bottles and we're going to save them like messages in a bottle forever. Like, what? I mean, how, I look back at that, I'm like, where are you even going to keep these bottles? How does that make any sense? Right. So I hid them in my pajama drawer, and my mom like still helps me with my laundry. So of course she's going to find them. And she like comes, she's all pissed one night, like picking me up from basketball. She brings me home and they're like laid out. And by that point, by the time we got home, I was pissed at her for like being pissed at me, but not telling me why. And I didn't know what was going on. And a lot of my story has to do with like rage and anger and violence. Can you tell? I like that job in Malibu. I punched my boyfriend in the face in a car and I broke my knuckle. Instantly, he was like totally fine, and my knuckle broke instantly. And I went into work and I tried to make up some lie, and but I had a pass like this, and they were like, no, that's a boxer break. Like I had no idea that that was a thing, and they like were like, who did you punch? And I again lied more about what I punched. Yeah, in alcoholism, I'm a big liar. And anyway, she was like, what is this? And I was mad at her, like, what's your problem? Da, da, da. And that was the first time though, she said, are you an alcoholic? I think you're an alcoholic. She thought I had been drinking all those by myself. And then I thought she was an idiot. And of course I am an alcoholic. And so the foreshadowing was there the whole time. But I did hear in the reading at the beginning is we have to concede to our innermost self. And so it didn't matter like whoever thought I was an alcoholic. In fact, in college, when I was partying with Gustav, I used to like bump that song so hard though, like, drink it if you really want it. Like, I'm a fucking alcoholic. ain't gotta put no extras on it, right? Like I was proud to be an alcoholic at that point. Like if you're not, like you're wasting your life. If you're not day drinking, you're literally wasting your life, is my mindset in college. And I was so I made it through high school though. Like it was messy. Like there was definitely messes, and I made messes in my relationships. So that's another key element. Like Christina said that like she has a boss that trusts her today, and she has like keys to other people's homes that trust her. And I did not have people that trusted me, or they shouldn't if they did. And I was messy. I didn't know how to show up in a relationship and not take my fears out on you, my anger out on you, and be entitled to. I was the way that I was entitled was I was like petty theft because like fuck the man, and like they'll never notice. The store won't notice if I steal like a picture frame. Like I would take random things, but I like would steal a picture frame because I need it more than they do, is like how I would justify it. And if they knew about what I was going through, and then like I made up so many excuses about why I could be the opposite of dignity and grace as a human being to make it okay. I justified my anger, and it was I there's that saying where you point one finger at someone else and three are pointing back at you. Like that's what I was doing with like it, but fuck you, but like really it was a me problem. And so I went to college, and it was not for knowledge. And I happened to be on, like, Yusuf was just saying, like, when I got here, we lived in the dorms together. We lived on the exact same floor in the dorms together. And he was like, we had such a crazy, like, floor. Like, we had a gang name for it and everything. But I don't think, like, we moved into a crazy floor. I think, like, we made it a crazy floor. Like, there was definitely other people involved, but, like, I was a big instigator of like all the drinking. Like I would finish my classes like whatever midday, and I would go to the gym because my like roommate did it, and I was like, okay, fine. And then what I realized that I could do is I could drink in the hot shower right after the gym when my blood was like pumping like this, and then take a really hot shower and like drink my first drink, my pre-party drink right then, and it would just like hit me so good. And so I had this like I never drank for the flavor. I always drank for the effect produced. And there's like a thing. First, they say like if you think you might be an alcoholic, you probably are, because people who are normies like know that they're normies. They don't question, "Am I alcoholic?" Like so, if you've ever questioned if you're an alcoholic, like you probably are, is maybe the mindset to just take away and be like, "Okay, how can I concede to my innermost self that this is true?" Because that's that key element. And so I knew I was an alcoholic, and I did not know about AA. I did not know about these rooms. I had never been introduced to them. I did not know that there was a solution. My wildest dreams, when you said I get to have dreams today, my wildest dreams was like I thought somehow I'm gonna be like an old grandma sitting on a front porch. It was always a front porch. And I'm gonna be smoking a blunt. And I'm like watching my grandkids with my drink, and I'm just gonna be like posted, and people are gonna come visit me, right? Like come give me hugs and kisses, bring me food. I'm just gonna be like blunted as a grandma. That was my dream. And I love weed, and so when weed became legal, I was like really like squirrely in my sobriety. Like it was difficult for me until like an old timer was like, "Yeah, but alcohol was always legal," and I was like, pfft. Like, okay, I get it. Like, all right, I can stay stopped from any mind-altering substance, because the self-respect that I have today as a result of that is something that is priceless, is the fact that people do trust me and that I trust myself. Like when people say that, like if you're still struggling with the mental obsession and you're still like waking up every morning and your head is loud, there's a lot more work to still be done. And the message that I carry is you don't have to live like that. My head is not loud when I wake up. My head is not loud when I go to put my head down at night. And I do rigorous work in this program. And I have used this foundation of sobriety to build upon it with other modalities. I've gotten curious about all different other things that can help me with my attachment disorder, basically, you know, like with my disordered way of attaching up until now, right? With my parenting, with my communication skills, with like my mindset, you know, like my fixed versus growth mindset. There's so much out there. And yet none of it would have ever been absorbed had I not already been sober and had this as my foundation. So every single other thing that I've achieved in my life on top of sobriety is a result of my sobriety. And I never let myself think that like I got there without being sober. Like I have to stay clear that my sobriety offered me everything good in my life today. So that it, when that thought like, oh, I can control it. Like what you guys read, I definitely like tried to control it. And I never really could. I couldn't control and enjoy it. And I think that's the key element that I learned from you guys, that an alcoholic can't control and enjoy our drinking. So we can do one or the other. Like I could control it for a little while, but I wasn't really enjoying it. I'd probably go home and I'd be like annoyed and like whatever, or, you know, be depressed because my companion, my best friend, was not there for me. Or I was enjoying it and not controlling it. So I can't do both. So if you can't do both, I hope you stay. I also, since finding AA, I have not gone out and done any other experimenting. I don't have relapse as a part of my story. And I think that's important for me to share because it doesn't have to be. It is for a lot of people, and that's okay too. And so I find that there's a smaller population that don't have relapse as part of their story. And it, your head can get loud. Mine did in the beginning, that maybe I need to, maybe, you know, maybe there's something else I need to try. There's so many yets I haven't had, you know, maybe I can do it differently this way and that way. And like, I was able to stay in the middle of a pack of women who were doing this thing to show me that the people who were going out, I stayed long enough to see people go out and come back in. And I saw people go out and die. And I saw what going out resulted in. And I didn't need to do that in order to convince myself that I was an alcoholic. So if it's not, if this is your first time, just you can stay. And if it's not, you can still be in the no matter what club, that now you stay sober no matter what. All right, I'm trying to like finish some more story here. So when we were moving out of the dorms, I don't really remember you being crazy, Gustav, but I always knew that like there was weed there. There was always weed around there. And you always seemed like a good guy to me. And like, that was something that like, I came into these rooms where people were like, you know, you don't seem that bad. Are you sure you need to do that? Like, you need to go full abstinence. And because I did have a job and I did have a car and I did have an apartment when I got sober, but I wanted to die. And I didn't think that I had a life worth living no matter what stuff I had. So when we were moving out of the dorms freshman year, everybody's like, whoever was coming to help them, they were all moving out. The whole dorms were like bustling and stuff. And I was in my bed with a giant black trash bag from the bathroom that somebody else had tied on my bedpost, my metal bedpost. And it was full of puke that I had like apparently thrown up in. I was like a really high functioning blackout drinker. So I could like walk in my heels, and a lot of you guys would let me drive in after drinking, because I could like present in a capacity that I could do stuff. But I would like, and I was such a liar. Oh my gosh, tonight is like really illuminating. That for me, I would pretend like I knew what you guys were talking about. Like when you would tell me what happened last night, I was like, yeah, yeah. And I would play along. I was never the chick who was like, well, I don't remember. Like what? You know, I did not want you guys to know that I was blacked out. So I had a lot of secrecy with my using. And even with weed, I had like this little packet of all my supplies that I needed. And I had like hand sanitizer for my nails. I had mouthwash in there. So I would like gargle a little bit, like swallow just a little bit, because I was so paranoid that you could like smell it on my breath. I had definitely like paranoia. And I had the eye drops, and I had like some like perfumey thing. I had this kit so that you wouldn't know that I was high. So I would spend all this money and time getting my high on. And then is that what the kids are calling it these days? I would spend all so much effort to get high. And then I would spend so much time being high, just trying to hide that I was high. And like, it was like, what for what? So that I didn't have to feel the way that I felt. right? I wanted to change the way that I felt, whether I wanted to feel better or usually I wanted to feel better, but even if I felt okay, I wanted to feel better than that. And I wanted to get outside of the way that I felt. And this was, I could take an outside substance and put it in me, and it was a power greater than myself. So when I removed that from me, I do believe in that thing they say, like, it's a God-shaped hole that we're like putting the alcohol in, and then like we remove it, and then it's like attention seeking. It's like food and shopping and like all the things that we put in there to try to fill this hole, and only God fits in it. And even alcohol doesn't fit, but alcohol was a power greater than me, right? It changed me when I turned to it. When I seeked it out, it changed me. I had a psychic change from using alcohol. So in order to take that out of my life, and my best friend, the thing that was there for me no matter what, and take that out of my life, I had to replace it with God. Otherwise, I was white knuckling and irritable, discontent, restless, right? I had to find a power greater than myself that wasn't about to take anything away from me at any moment, right? A power that I truly trusted, that I really believed was loving me through everything, no matter what it looked like on the surface. And I had to replace that in the place where I used to use alcohol. And so like, I heard people say that, like, well, whatever you would do to like get what you needed to get drunk or high, like apply that to being sober. Like if you would drive to the Inland Empire right now to get your stuff, like then like if I would drive to the OC to get my stuff, then I'm going to drive to the OC to share my story. Right. So we can't stay drunk on yesterday's booze. Right? That's like that concept. We can't say like, yeah, like high and drunk on the stuff we did then. We have to redo it every day, right? We have to get loaded again each day. So I applied that same thing to AA. Like, I can't stay sober on yesterday's AA. I have to redo it again today, again and again and again today, in order to keep this high going, in order to keep this high on God, this ease and flow that I get when I align my will with God's will. I have to keep showing up to getting high on that every single day. I have to take my higher power, right? Like, I have to take my drug of choice today, which is a reliance upon God. And so I got sober at 27. I really realized like my life was just like not going anywhere, and everything that I like had really achieved, I had somehow thrown it away, or like didn't really believe that I was worthy of having it anyways, because I cheated to get it, you know? And so the very last time I drank, it was Halloween weekend, and I had like, bless you. You're welcome. Thank you. you know what, just what it takes to stay present in the moment, right? Like, we're here, there's really nothing wrong, we're safe right now. Like, everything else is like one foot in yesterday and one foot in tomorrow, and that's the perfect place to piss on today. Right? So everything else, right, is not even real yet. It's just our fears and our like grief, right? It's our anxiety and our depression. That's where it lives, yesterday and tomorrow. But like right here, right now, like I am going through life on life's terms. And yet like in this moment, we are safe. We're sober, we're alive. And this is the only moment we really have. And anytime I can like get present again, because something sparks that in me, like I'm able to now, because I'm super sober, use a sneeze to get present. So yeah, I got sober. My last drink, I don't remember it. And well, I do remember drinking before the blackout, and it was half XO and half Patron on the rocks. That was the last thing I drank. And it was at the Cabo Cantina in Venice. And apparently like I started to fall down the stairs, and they put me in a cab, and I told the cab to take me to this guy's house that I was like hooking up with. And I like pushed all the buttons. They could like see me from like their apartment window. And I like pushed everything to get in, because he had already told me, I don't like you when you're drinking. I don't want to hang out with you when you're drinking. Like, don't come around. And here I am. And somebody like came to let me in, and I was like, no, you're not my friend. You know, like I didn't take the help, which is another big part of sobriety. Like, being able to stay sober is learning how to accept help and ask for help. And I found that in this program that, when you ask for help, especially from another sober person, you're giving them the opportunity to be of service. So it's a gift to them for you to ask for help. So when I started to think about it that way, I was like, okay, I'm being of service by asking somebody else to help me because then they get to be of service. And like that helped me be willing to ask, to be humble, to say, I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know how to, I don't know. And I see that you might know. Can you please help me figure this out? So I was like, no, I don't need your fucking help. Is how I imagine it, and how they told me, how they reflected it back to me. So finally, his roommate lets me up, and I guess I tried to pee in their plant. And I was a puke and rally kind of person, so I would like puke in your like vase, and then I'd like hide it behind something, and just keep going. Like so many people must have found throw up wherever, or I just like puke in the bush, and they're like, I'm here, let's go, you know. So my body was rejecting it always. My hangovers were horrible. My hangovers were so horrible, and I would like use a 5 hour energy and soda water. I couldn't even drink plain water. I would puke it up and mead and like I would and bread and I like I couldn't even eat greasy food. It was just like a piece of bread, and I would like be like this and like oh and like crawling to the bathroom on my hands and knees and puking. And then by like 6 p.m., you know, like okay guys, I'm back. I got this. Let's go. It was gross. So anyways, I woke up the next morning. I was on a bare mattress, naked, and there was a pile of puke on one side of the bed, and there was a pile of my clothes full of piss on the other side of the bed. Right? Decomprehensible demoralization, incomprehensible demoralization. And I did not remember it, but they told me that I was rocking back and forth, pleading with my Santa Claus God that if you take away this pain, I won't drink for 10 years. And when they told me that, I was like, oh, shit. You know, okay, I guess I can do one day. I guess I could do a week. And like my goal in the beginning was like this 10-year idea that I had like finally, for some reason, that time it was just desperate enough. You know, I was just bad enough that I was like willing to not drink that day. And now I'm 12, and that's crazy. And so it was in November, and I used New Year's Eve as like an excuse. I was bartending at the time at the Whaler in Venice, and I was like, and we could drink on the clock, and so people were always trying to buy shots and stuff. And this guy knows the Whaler, and it was crazy. Like we didn't have to wear uniforms; like we could do whatever we wanted. And so like I was like, oh no, I kind of laid low for the holidays. I'm not gonna drink for a year. I did like the dry, like when you're gonna just not drink for a year. I thought that was like a thing. You make a New Year's resolution. So I like told people that that's what it was. And then so much good stuff like happened from me putting it down in that year that like I remember one of the other girls, like when that year came around, she was like, yeah, you can drink on New Year's Eve again with us. Da, da, da. I was like, you know what? I think I'm just gonna stay stopped. I think I'm just gonna ride this as long as I can because like my life has gotten significantly better. And so like thank you, no thank you. And it doesn't mean that I didn't want to. It doesn't mean that I didn't go through a breakup and like want to get rid of that pain. My dad has died suddenly in sobriety, and I stayed sober no matter what. I was a secretary of a meeting, and I thought I had no message to carry, and I didn't know how I was going to show up for my sponsees. And my sponsor told me that you're carrying the message with the most depth and weight of any message at all, and that's that you're staying sober no matter what. When life on life's terms happens, and my dad and I had mended our relationship through those first few years of my sobriety. And we were at like the height of our relationship. We were the closest we'd ever been, and we were like, it broke my heart more than it would have at a younger age. And I stayed stopped. And so I absolutely do not want to sell a message that it's just all good. It is not all good in sobriety. If the thing is that we have the power of choice. When we stay stopped, no matter what, we have the power of choice. We can choose what we do next. And if we're still catching, when I was still catching myself, breaking things, bless you, breaking things, like because I was mad at you know, like taking something and slamming it on the floor, when I was catching myself still doing something that didn't feel like a choice, I had the choice to get curious about that, right? I had the choice to look underneath that behavior and where is this coming from and what is hurting so deep down inside that I'm still having to violently act out on people in sobriety. And I think that's an important part of how I've stayed stopped too, is like, is what, bless you. That acronym of how How do we do it? Honesty, open-mindedness, willingness. And open-mindedness to me means like I'm open to believing. That's like where the faith lives, really. Like I'm open to believing that I don't know the outcome and I don't know all the ways that this could like play out, and that it could play out better, or it could play out with a positive purpose if that's the perspective that I pick, because it's a disease of perception. So if my perception is, thank you, is that it's going to have a positive purpose in the long run, and I have to be patient and stay in action in the meantime to see it play out that way, it has. And so a year after my dad died, it was a really dark year. And I had actually just gotten married, and he died a week after I got married. And a year went around, and we were honoring the anniversary. And it was right around Father's Day too. And it's heavy. It's like not something that I wanted to feel. And I was able to turn towards gratitude because somebody told me that a grateful alcoholic never drank. That like, if you're getting close to a drink, it probably means that your gratitude is missing. Like that's what somebody told me. And that worked for me. I was like, holy shit, right? Like I have so much to be grateful for. I have some fresh water. I can see, right? I can walk. Like there's enough to be grateful to hold on to if I'm focused on that. So I was able to focus on gratitude and see that he died a week after our wedding and not a week before, that he was able to walk me down the aisle. And like the last time that most people ever saw him was like one of the happiest moments of his life. And like, yes, I wish he was here to like be in my children's lives. And so yes, I still wish it was different. Right. And I have acceptance for how it is. And I'm living within the reality of what it is, because the book tells us that acceptance is the answer to all my problems today. Because when I'm not accepting the reality, like when I'm wishing it would be different so badly that like I'm trying to change or alter myself to control or manipulate the outcome, or like I'm sitting in something that I can't change no matter what, because it's the thing that I have to accept because it's out of my control, but I'm trying to have the courage to change it, right? I'm not clear on the serenity prayer on which is my part and which is not. If I get into acceptance is the answer to all my problems today, if I accept what is right now, whatever it is that's happening, then I have the power to change it, because I'm living in reality instead of fantasy about what I wish it was. So that's been a key element to staying stopped for me, is the acceptance and surrender. Like somebody told me that to surrender means to join the winning team. And I was like, oh, well, that doesn't sound bad. You know, like, yeah, I want to win. I want to join you guys. So if I surrender into AA, you guys are winning. You guys are winning at this sober thing. So if I surrender into what you guys are doing to stay stopped, then I can join you and walk this broad path with you. And I have an ease and flow about my life today, even when things are heavy emotionally, even when I am hurting. I make my primary purpose staying sober and helping other alcoholics and my family and aligning my will to God's will for my life. So it seemed like so elusive in the beginning. And I was like, well, what does that mean? Like, how do I know if it's God's will, or how do I know if it's my anxiety? You know, like, how do I know? And so for me, I just had to I had to keep it simple. I do think that simple is our superpower. And I was just like, okay, my God is love. And so if I'm thinking something loving or I'm doing something loving, then I've turned my will and my life over to God. My will is my thoughts. My life is my actions. And if I'm doing something or thinking something loving, then I have, for me, turned my will and my life over to the care of God. And if I'm not, then I just know that's my self-will, right? If I'm like talking about how, if I'm like talking about gossip or character assassination about how selfish she is because she did this, you know, like I can see that that's my self-will. And that's like a lot more obvious to me now. But there's other things too, like still when it comes to sugar, right? Like I can clearly see my will and that like what I'm eating when I'm eating candy in bed at night is not loving to my body. So then I know that's my will for my life. And like left to my own devices, that will run riot on me. And it has, like I've had inflammation and migraines and blah, 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 right? So I get to see my alcoholism at 12 years sober in action without having to pick up. I definitely thought I was gonna pick up weed. at some point. And I have conceded to my innermost self that I'm not going to do that, right? Just for today. Because maybe I'll get high tomorrow, but just for today, I'm going to stay stopped. And then every time tomorrow comes, it's today again. And so if just for today, I'm going to stay stopped no matter what, then it's always in the present moment today. I'll just push off my getting high for tomorrow. And then tomorrow never really comes because then it's today. And like these little tricks have like helped me to just get through that next thought, that next breath, you know, when I have one or two. So I have three kids now. My oldest is my stepdaughter. We have full custody. So I'm a mom of three. And so in COVID, I was homeschooling and I started drinking caffeine earlier and earlier and earlier. And then it was like, and I had stopped energy drinks when I got pregnant. I had never really drank coffee. It was always energy drinks. And so then I wasn't pregnant anymore. And I was like drinking energy. And so I was like taking a Red Bull to my nightstand so that in the morning when the kids were up and I was like cracking a Red Bull and like starting to drink it. And then it was like two Red Bulls in the day or three. Like in COVID, I could see clearly that if I could just drink wine normally with my friend when I go out, right? I could see that it would progress to like, oh, now I'm having like a mimosa and now I'm just having vodka. Right? Like I can see the progression through other things. I don't have to pick up to know that I'm a true alcoholic today because of the mental obsession and because that I want things for the effect produced. Right? So my sister passed in 2022 at 33 years old. My uncle just passed last June. I was really close to him. He never had any kids. He came to every basketball game. And my father-in-law just passed a couple weeks ago. And I was able to be there for my sister, you know, sober. And I was able to see that, like, I had been killing myself while she, our whole life, had been like just wanting to live, like doing everything in her power to stay alive. And I was taking it for granted and I was fully functioning, right? And I had all these opportunities that she was never gonna have and I was throwing it away. And like that perspective shift helped me so much too. And like I got to be there for her to the end. And she ended up passing in my mom's bed at a different house, but she passed in my mom's bed at home also, like the same way that she was born. And like that could have happened. She could have died anywhere at any time our whole life. My older sister had come in and she was a pediatric ICU nurse and she pronounced the time of death. Christina actually came to my house. I had to take my stepdaughter to something that was like she had won this thing in Girl Scouts and it was happening only once a year. And I left. I wasn't there in the moment that my sister died. And Christina went to my house because I was like, I don't know what's gonna happen. Like, and she prayed over my sister and saw the angels in the room and my sister pronounced the time of death, our older sister, and my husband said, she said 11:03. And he was like, holy shit, that's London sobriety date. My sister's time of death was my sobriety date. And like, I'm a believer that is it odd or is it God? And it's going to be whichever we choose because it's a disease of perception. You know, the perspective that we pick. And so I choose that it's God working in my life. So whenever I see something, I have this omen about dimes too. If I see a dime, I just believe that I'm on the right track for my life, whatever it is. So I see a dime and then I'm like, oh, thanks. Okay. You know, like just little things, but like I choose to see it as God. I see angel numbers on the clock. I choose to see it as God working in my life. Since my father-in-law has passed, I've heard like significant songs that mattered to him on the radio that like is not normal for me. And I'm like, okay, you know, I'm gonna lean into this is God working in my life. So the more I look for God working into my life, the more it's there. And like to me, God never moves away from me. If I don't feel close to God, it's because I've turned. It's because I've taken my hand down it and put it in my pocket. You know, I've let go. And I do believe that my higher power is here for me at all times, available if I turn towards God. And if I don't, I'm turning towards alcohol. It's always a fork in the road. It's pick one. It's fear or love. It's relapse or recovery, right? It's like fear or faith, right? There's always a fork in the road. That works for me because as an alcoholic, it's black or white, right? Like, we live in the gray, but just like for me to keep it to make sense in my mind, like on a daily basis, it's just like anytime I'm in fear, okay. Well, how do I get to faith? Like, what can I have faith about in this moment? And that has worked for me. And I hope that this sharing of that will inspire you to consider, you know, how is God working in my life? What is my God? And like, how can my God be so big that it's not something that ever turns against me or punishes me or lets me down? Because like the high that I got off of alcohol and drugs, I always crashed from. And the high that I've experienced through relying on this book and this program and all of you is something that I'm able to maintain as long as I stay in the action. I love to say that, like, instead of faith without works is dead, I love to say that faith with works is alive. Like, that's how I keep myself alive and sober, is to like have faith and to do the part, because we are the actors in the drama, right? So we have to be the ones that physically live it out. God could have all these opportunities right there, right behind the curtain for us, but if we don't get on stage and do the action, if I just stay in my bed and binge watch shows and eat sugar and cry and be depressed, like, you know, I'm not going to experience all the miracles that really are just right here for us at all times. I'm going to close with this. I was taught that like the steps are kind of like, step one is like, I'm sick. Step two is like, I'm going to go to the doctor, right? Came to believe in power greater than ourselves. Like, when we go to the doctor, we do believe that they have more knowledge than us, like in that moment, like we're looking for something that they had that we don't, right? And then, so I'm sick. I go to the doctor, which is God. In AA. And then I make a decision to my will and my life. That means I'm going to follow the instructions that they give me. I'm going to, right, we're going to follow the steps. And then number four is getting the prescription and like now needing to take it, right? And I was never able to take prescriptions as prescribed. So I don't keep myself to having to do anything else like perfectly, right? I don't have to do it as prescribed. I need to be doing it. But the only one that I need to do like consistently and really like fully is step one, that I've admitted I'm powerless over alcohol, and then step two, and then step three. And then the rest to me is like, has been trial and error and learning what works for me and what doesn't, and like following this and like being like, okay, this was the best I could do at step four when I first did it. And now I have more awareness, I have more understanding. And so now I can do another one and I can go deeper, right? Like just doing the best that we can where we're at and not trying to do it all at once. And there's steps for a reason, because we're not supposed to look at the whole staircase and then be like, oh, I can never get to the top. We're just supposed to look at the next step and the next step and do the next right indicated action. And through that, I've stayed stopped consistently over a very long period of time. And I hope that you will too. Thank you.
Let's thank our speaker, London, again. Our alcoholic has been asked to come up and read the promises and lead us out in the Lord's Prayer.
Good evening. My name is Lindsay, and I am a grateful alcoholic. And I just had to say really quick too, the 10-minute speaker talked about the promises when she first read it, how it opened up her heart so much. And I hope it opens up everyone's hearts, because it has mine too. The promises. If we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. We are going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past, nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity, and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of usefulness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? We think not. They are being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly and sometimes slowly. They will always materialize if we work for them.